Welcome back to Bubble Trouble. The double act of independent analyst Richard Kramer, that's me, and the economist and author Will Page, that's him. We train on your pain. That's why we never seem to learn from past bubbles that get our portfolios into trouble. When we will not get fooled again, I don't know. We've been exposing sycophants and stenographers for over a century, but now we want to move on to the topical topic of tweets and Twitter. How do you gauge the impact of Elon Musk's shock therapy over the past 2 years? How did it even come to this? Bubble Trouble welcomes longtime Bloomberg journalist Kurt Wagner, who's just done a deep dive profile of the tortured history, especially tortured over the last couple of years, of Twitter. We're going to come back with Kurt, deep dive into what's happened to Twitter, how it became X, and what it's going to happen in the future. Back in a moment.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Kurt, welcome to the show. Honor to get you on. Thank you for giving up your precious time as a journalist at Bloomberg. You're here to talk about the book Battle for the Bird and the story of Twitter, now known as X. I feel like I've got it easy, because I never actually joined Twitter. So I missed that sewer of social media, and now I get a conversation with yourself to understand what happened and what went wrong. Let's start just by introducing yourself, a quick word about the book, but really important, tell our audience where they can follow your work.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. This is a fun opportunity to talk with both of you, but also to talk about this work that I've been doing for the last couple of years. As you mentioned, my name is Kurt Wagner. I've been a journalist at Bloomberg for 5 years, covering social media, specifically, usually Meta and what is now X, formerly Twitter. I wrote a book, Battle for the Bird, which we can talk all about it, but originally started this project actually before Elon showed up in the picture. So I thought this was going to be more of a traditional Twitter Jack Dorsey book, and it sort of morphed.
You had to tweak the manuscript.
I did. I had to follow the story, as they say, which is good. So Battle for the Bird is out. I'm really excited and proud of it, and hopefully people will give it a shot. And yeah, I write for Bloomberg weekly, sometimes daily, depending on the news cycle. And I'm still on X at Kurt Wagner 8. And I'm also on Threads and LinkedIn and sort of all the different social platforms. So if folks want to find me, I'm not too hard to find.
Well, we always try and start Bubble Trouble with a guest by just assuming no prior knowledge. So let's assume that nobody knows Twitter actually relates to a bird and not a social media platform. Do you want to just kind of summarize, how did the company come into being? On the eighth day, God did not create Twitter, somebody else did. Who created it and why?
Sure. In order to get this part of the story, you have to go way back to late 2005, early 2006, to a podcasting company in San Francisco called Odeo. And the group at Odeo was trying to help people discover podcasts, startup, very classic Silicon Valley tech startup. And unfortunately, Apple came out with iTunes, and they are sitting there going, oh my gosh, well, I guess our podcasting business is doomed. We need to come up with another idea. And so this group sort of spent a little time brainstorming. And one of the ideas was this idea for essentially AOL Instant Messenger display, an away message or an up status update from your phone. And so this was the idea they went with. And Jack Dorsey was the main guy building this new idea, this new AOL, but on your phone thing. And so eventually this idea sort of took on a life of its own. People liked the idea of getting to update their friends and colleagues or family about, hey, what am I doing, right? It was really simple at the beginning. It was like, I'm eating this, I'm listening to this type of music, I'm walking down this street, whatever you're doing in your life. But that's the original seed for what Twitter became. Obviously, it's morphed into something that's so much more than that, and we can talk about that. But Jack Dorsey, Biz Stone, Noah Glass, and Ev Williams, kind of the four guys at the center of this transition from Odeo to what became Twitter. And that was really the idea behind it, was how can I update people about what I'm doing on the go? And it's morphed from there.
Wow. So it started, if I get my tech years right, which is not easy to do, it started pre-MySpace and potentially pre-YouTube as well. Is that correct?
I think it was post-MySpace. I'd have to go back. But 2006 would have been post-MySpace. Facebook started in 2004, so it was right on the heels of Facebook's founding.
Google bought YouTube in 2006.
Yeah, so it was right around, so yeah. These things existed, but they were all new together, like Facebook,
right.
YouTube, Twitter, those were all kind of coming in the same 2, 3, 4 year time span, I would say.
But wasn't it also at the time when the U.S. was struggling or was grappling with this notion of SMS? We had SMS, short message services on mobile, very early on in Europe, and they really took off like wildfire as a person-to-person messaging. But you hadn't the WhatsApps yet, the sort of one-to-many group messaging. And I know Twitter was something that back in that time frame, Nokia, which was the largest mobile phone company in the world, looked at taking a 25% stake in Twitter and didn't. They thought of that as an outcropping of the SMS business.
Well, this was pre-iPhone. And so the way that tweets were delivered for the first 2 years was via SMS. So you would go... And if you, there was a website, there was twitter.com you could go to. But if you were on the go and you were trying to read these and you followed, let's pretend, Richard, I followed you in 2006, you would tweet something and it would actually show up on my phone as an SMS text. And so that's how people were sort of getting these updates. And that's why someone like Nokia would be interested in investing in Twitter, because they're sitting here seeing, oh, wow, millions, if not billions of text messages are flowing through this business. I think the iPhone changed all that, of course, right? Because now suddenly you could build an app to receive this stuff on your phone versus the SMS. But it did start with text messages.
Give us the numbers on Twitter in absolute and relative context. For our listeners who may not be that familiar with it, how big is Twitter relative to its neighbors?
So caveat being, we don't know for sure because Twitter is no longer a publicly traded company. For years, we were able to get revenue, profits, losses, daily active user totals, quarterly, right, through earnings reports. So we don't have that anymore. So what we do have is I actually went and I wrote these down so that I could get them right for you guys. We have the numbers from 2022, which was the last time that Twitter was a publicly traded company. We have some numbers that Elon has sort of talked about as the new owner of X, which not everyone necessarily takes at face value, but I can share those too. So in 2022, the last quarter that Twitter reported earnings, which is Q2, middle of the year 2022, it was 238 million daily users. Okay. For context, Meta, which owns Facebook was 2.1 billion users, right? So I have to do my math, but I'd say that's about 10%, maybe a little bit more than 10% of Facebook's audience is on Twitter. It hasn't gone up dramatically. Elon now claims they have 250 million daily users, I believe. So from 238 to 250. But again, there's some, not everyone necessarily takes those numbers at face value. I think the bigger thing is the user base is important, but tweets showed up everywhere, right? So you probably see tweets on your local news. You might see tweets at a stadium if you're at a game. So even though it was a smaller audience, you still felt like you saw tweets it felt like the audience was bigger than 238 million because of that. I think the bigger issue was the business, right? So Twitter, even though it gets talked about in the same breath often as a Facebook or Instagram or whatever, the business is just minuscule compared to those. So again, well, let's go back to 2022, the last time we knew with confidence what size the business was. They did about $2.4 billion in revenue for the first half of that year. We'll say they were going to be around 5, maybe a little over 5 for that year if you were to extrapolate. Again, Meta did $36.5 billion in revenue in the first quarter this past year. I just reported their earnings a couple weeks ago. So $5 billion annually from Twitter, $36.5 billion in a quarter from Meta. Right.
$150 billion run rate. Yeah.
That just gives you a sense of how small Twitter or now X is compared to some of these other companies that it gets talked about with.
Well, and certainly X is a lot smaller. Now, if I dig in, I'm going to go, before I get to all the questions I prepared, I mean, I'll give you my sense for years since I covered Twitter since IPO of their business model, which is if you see Will and I running along in Hampstead Heath and chatting amiably, you pay us no mind. But if we were to stop and start screaming at each other, you might stop and stare. And I always felt that for years, that was Twitter's business model, that they were trying to encourage that kind of conflictual dissension, that torrent of either abuse or invective or whatever, that would you would stop and stare, kind of aghast in a way. And they maybe went over the top on it because Twitter became overrun, certainly for many years, with bots and automated programs that and really content that wasn't brand safe, where people would be threatened with all sorts of terrible things. There are many reports from Amnesty International, for example, about how toxic Twitter and all the abuse of women on Twitter, for example. Is that your sense of the business model? That's why, that explains why it was always a $5 billion business compared to $150 billion at Meta, that they never got beyond that sort of monetizing rage?
I think there's a few things. Number one, I think you've identified a key problem, not just with Twitter, but with social media probably in general. But I think it's more pronounced on Twitter because you don't have as much, like Twitter was so focused on text versus video or photos or things, that the way to stand out amid a stream of text is to post something that's inflammatory, post a hot take, right. Post something that's right. Going to generate attention, right? And that was not always positive. I do think that was a hindrance to the business because you always had these companies who were saying, do we want to be associated with Twitter? Do we want to put a big portion of our ad budget to this company, knowing that it might show up next to this inflammatory stuff? I also think, though, there is a technical sort of business element to this story, which is that Twitter never built the type of ad business that Google and Facebook ultimately dominate, which is direct response ads, right? Like Twitter was, until its sale to Elon, I think it was something like 80% brand marketing, right? And in this day and age, in 2024, or back then in 2022, what works on the internet is a very specific type of ad, which is like, I'm targeting you, Richard. I know exactly what you want. I'm going to show it to you, and I'm going to drive you to that website or that retailer or whatever. And Twitter just wasn't doing that. And so I think like you have two issues. You have the content issue, which you've identified, but then you also have the technical issue, which is they just didn't set themselves up for success in 2022 internet digital advertising space.
And let me link that to one of the key sort of the central figure of your book, which I've read, and it felt like I relived all these experiences I had watching the company from the outside. But your book personalizes Twitter a lot around Jack Dorsey. And in some sense, creating that ad product story, is that a function of Jack's personality, that he just wasn't that engaged? He wasn't the kind of person who wanted to make the link between A and B. We're going to show you an ad, you're going to buy something. He was this aloof, mercurial figure that if you thought he was kind of running the company, well, he had to be doing it in half of his time.
I think that's right. And I don't think it was necessarily that he didn't want to show targeted ads. I don't think he cared about the business really at all. And if you talk to, you know, that I'm being a little perhaps dramatic, obviously, but like if you talk to people who were on the business side of Twitter, they never felt that Jack was that invested in making money at the company. And if you get to know him and his personality, he's an idealist. He's the kind of person who thought Twitter's space in the world was, he sort of viewed it as like, hey, this is this megaphone for free speech and this megaphone for discussion. And it's, he talked about this idea of Twitter being like the global consciousness, right? Like, what is the world thinking? What is the world talking about? Like, that is what Twitter provides. Right. And I don't think he ever wanted or felt like building Twitter into this massive business a la Facebook was something that he cared to do. And so when you don't have that direction from the CEO, when you don't have that prioritization from the CEO, the business side falls behind, quite frankly. And I think that was ultimately a Jack failure, but I also think it was a board failure, right? Like Twitter's board of directors, Jack's boss, should have said, we are a publicly traded company. Like, we need to be focused on making money. That's what we do. Like, that will enable us to do the idealistic things Jack wants to do. But I just don't think they ever quite got there.
Right. And I do want to throw out my one big theory about Twitter, which is it very quickly in 2016, when it first ran into trouble, became controlled by Google. So Omid Kordestani became chairman. He was number eight at Google, chief business officer. He then took over as chairman, ended up passing the reins to Google's former CFO, Patrick Pichette. Google wanted to make sure that Twitter never became a threat to its ads business. They wanted access to all the data, and they had the majority of seats on the board. So they were happy for Twitter to perpetually remain a dysfunctional company, that they had access to all the data without ever feeling like their ads business was going to bleed share to Twitter. Do you think it was purposely left to run as poorly as it had by that board? Or do you think they just were, in the end, incompetent?
You're more cynical on that than I am, probably. I do think, like, was it in Google's interest for Twitter to be this massive advertising business? Like, absolutely not, right? Same with Facebook. Like they had to be sitting there saying, we love watching Twitter take their 1% share of digital global ad market every year and never grow that pie, but still provide sort of like competition. We're now talking about like antitrust. We're now talking about Twitter had to show up at hearings with YouTube and Facebook and all this stuff, even though they were 1/10 the size. So like, I think those companies were happy to sit there probably and watch Twitter sort of flounder. I'm not sold that this was like an intentional, hey, we're going to sabotage this from the inside. You have to remember about Omid and Patrick Pichette. I mean, those guys were longtime Google employees, as you mentioned, but they weren't at Google while they were on the board. So it's not as if like Google had active employees that were on the board of Twitter sabotaging the company, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That being said, so then, okay, well, what's the alternative? Well, again, I think there was this kind of reluctance from the board to hold Jack accountable to grow a business. And as a result, they were like, well, Jack's sort of famous. He's the founder. He's a bit famous in Silicon Valley. Like, Twitter still gets all this attention. So it's not like they were short of attention. They were just short on the business front. And I'm not sure if you could go back in time and say, hey, you need to get this direct response ads business off the ground much sooner. I would hope that would have been something that they would have done earlier. But, you know, for whatever reason, they just never pushed Twitter to do that.
If I can just bridge both opinions there, from Rich's cynicism to your sort of passing on the cynicism, those people might not have been Google employees, but they might have been sitting on a ton of Google stock that still had a vesting schedule whilst sitting on the board of Twitter.
No, for sure.
Just sowing a seed.
Don't get me wrong. Like I said, I don't think anyone at Google or who has a financial investment in Google would necessarily say, we want Twitter to become our next big rival, right? Like, they're happy to let this thing kind of flounder. Again, when it comes to Omid and Patrick, like, yes, they probably had a ton of Google stock. They got compensated to be on the Twitter board too, right? Like, I mean, Twitter doing well was not only in their financial interest, but it was also in their reputational interest, right? Like, Omid in particular, he's the chairman. He's sort of considered Jack Dorsey's like mentor when he came to take that job. Twitter doing well makes him look good. And so I don't get the sense that there was any, let's put it this way, reporting out the book, I didn't learn of any foul play. I didn't get the sense that like they were sitting there drumming their fingers saying, oh, I can't wait for this company to fail. I would be very shocked if that was the mindset. I do think, as we've pointed out, Google, Facebook were happy to let Twitter be sort of the very, very distant fifth, sixth, seventh player in the world of digital ads.
And since you were there in the belly of the beast at the time, I mean, it just astonished me, the reporting in your book, that a company, I never realized as a financial analyst, but that they could waste so much money on parties and all that stuff. I mean, you can't really imagine that they would fly the entire company for like a week-long jamboree, and you wondered why they were always missing their numbers and why costs were so high, and you just kept reporting on all this succession of parties they would be having.
Yeah, they were...
I thought that was the best part of your book and the best part of working at Twitter.
Oh, yeah. It would have been the best part of working at Twitter for sure. So there were two what were called one teams. The first was in 2018, And as far as financials, it was more subdued of the two, but still, you can imagine flying every Global employee. So at that time, I want to say it was like 4,500 people or something. I'm forgetting the exact numbers, but several thousand people, flying them from all around the world to San Francisco, putting them up in hotels, renting Moscone Center, they had musical artists who performed. They had drinks,
salt juice,
parties.
Salt juice. Yeah, don't forget the salt juice.
Yeah, little lemon, salt, water, mix that up for a nice little breakfast cocktail. So that was in 2018. And this was originally like the idea was to build camaraderie, to build this idea of like, let's get everyone excited about working at Twitter again. Because you have to remember, it was a dark time. They had gone through layoffs back-to-back years. 2016, 2017 had done layoffs. Trump had been elected president, was using Twitter every single day to basically like attack his rivals, attack Twitter itself, attack Congress. And there was this feeling inside the company at the time that like working at Twitter kind of sucked. It was the dark days, right? They're not making money. They're laying people off. Their service is sort of used to like bully. The president of the United States is using the service to bully
people.
The
stock was in the toilet.
The stock was down. So they kind of, the 2018 one was, we need to do something radical here to sort of get, to breathe some life into this company.
Right.
2 years later, it was such a success, or it was viewed as such a success, that 2 years later, they decided to do it again in early 2020, right before COVID hit. And that one was where I feel like it morphed into more of a party, right? Like the first one, I think you could sort of justify, hey, it's a big expense, but we have all these reasons for it. 2020 was like, they went to Houston. It was $30 million, I was told, was the cost of this like company-wide three-day retreat.
What?
And when
you can't spend $30 million in a retreat.
You can, and you did. And I think like if you were Meta, if you were Google, you can get away with that, right? You're literally printing, but you're getting $30 million in profit every week, whatever.
20 minutes.
Every 20 minutes. I'm making these up off the top of my head. Unfortunately, Twitter's business was not in that level of success. And so when you talk about $30 million, I think it just hit home a lot harder with some people at the company, like even employees who were there, they were like, yeah, we had a great time, like super irresponsible way of spending $30 million, right? So not everyone was on board with it.
And maybe just before we wrap up for this first part, one of the things, and this is completely selfish, I felt you missed in the book, was one of really the triumphant moments of my Arete stock calling career was that the day when the stock, we were the only analyst firm out of 42 analysts that had a sell on the stock, and the stock went down like 20 or 30% in a day. And it feels like, in a way, you, even working for Bloomberg, you talked very little about the machinations and gyrations of the stock and the stock market having an effect on the company. And I've just got to wonder, were people blasé and completely insulated and weren't paying attention to the stock price? Was it just tangential to the massive soap opera? And frankly, which you do cover well in the book, the Game of Thrones management team, because it was a constantly revolving, they had 14 people present at the 2016 Analyst Day, and a year later, 12 of them were gone. And I don't know how you can run a company when you have that. Was that stock price performance that I was watching like a hawk just something that people just didn't pay attention to? Or was it a part of the story, but it just overwhelmed by all these characters you have in the book?
I think it's more the latter. I think it's like, did employees, were they aware like, hey, the stock is trading an all-time low? Hey, did I just lose 20% of my stock value? Like, of course they did, right? I think it's a few things. One, it's not the most compelling thing for a book narrative, right? To constantly be checking in with like, and the stock fell 8% that day or whatever. But what I did try to do was hit some milestones, right? And obviously I missed the one that you brought up, the big dip that I know that you called. But, you know, I talked a lot about like how the stock price and the pressure of being a Wall Street publicly traded company really weighed on Jack Dorsey. I talked about how it weighed on company decisions. So where I didn't necessarily get into maybe the specifics of the up and down of the daily price, I tried to get across that the fact that Twitter was publicly traded was a huge factor in what drove decisions and what ultimately led Jack Dorsey to leave the company. Like he was so sort of, by the end, anti-Wall Street, anti-publicly traded company, that I think that was a huge reason that he ultimately chose to leave his role.
Well, and clearly he tried to, as you describe in the book, they tried to sell the company actively and hired a couple times, hired bankers, and were at the altar with Disney, who looked at the kind of invective and abuse you see on Twitter all the time and just walked away.
Yeah, that's right. That was one of my favorite chapters, because I know it was old news in the sense that, like, we're talking about a deal that almost happened in 2016. It was. I remember covering it at the time. It was known that Disney and Twitter were talking. It was known that Salesforce and Twitter were talking. But I don't think people fully appreciated just how close it got. I also don't think people knew, and one of the details I had in there was that after Disney initially walked away, they actually came back to the table for a very brief time. So Bob Iger says, hey, it's too toxic here. We're going to walk away. Sorry. But a few weeks later, they actually came back and they had one final discussion about sort of a lowball price that obviously didn't end up happening. But the reason I wanted to get into all that in the book was, like, I felt that it was important for people to understand that this was a company that had been seeking a savior for a long time, right? And yeah, they had spent years trying to figure out, can we make it as a publicly traded company? And if not, who's going to save this company? Who's going to come in and sort of protect us, put an umbrella over us? And they didn't find that person or that company. And so, unfortunately, that just meant they had to do it on their own. And for a while, they were able to. And I think, like, they were able to grow to a $5 billion plus annual revenue business, which is nothing to shake your head at. It just didn't live up to the expectations that had been set by, quite frankly, their own leadership team and Wall Street.
Yeah.
Kurt, last one before we cut it off to part one. And we've talked a lot about Jack. We'll be talking a lot about Elon in part two. Yeah. But one quote from the analyst Benedict Evans, which always rang true for me, which is, as an outsider looking in, how did it feel like an insider looking out? Which is, Benedict Evans said, Twitter is a place where good ideas go to die. Would you agree with that observation? If you're a promising engineer, developer, and you turn up at Twitter for your first day at office with all these bright ideas, is that how you would feel?
I think, unfortunately, the examples sort of speak for themselves, right? You look at the missed opportunities at Twitter over the years, and Vine being probably top of the list, right? Vine was TikTok before TikTok existed, and I was in the building. They owned it, and they had the creators. They had sort of the community growing, and they just sort of mishandled it, right? I think you even talk about kind of Periscope and live video. Like, I actually thought the idea of pairing Twitter with TV wasn't the worst idea back in the day. Like, there was this whole real thing where, like, I'm watching sports on TV and I am tweeting about it and I'm reading tweets about it. And, like, let's pair this together, right? And I think they came with that idea. They bought the NFL rights for some Thursday night football games. And I think on paper, that made a lot of sense. I think the execution, unfortunately, just was not there. Like, they didn't really build a dedicated product for it. They didn't build a dedicated experience for it. And it was good idea, poor execution. And I think there's just a lot of examples of that over the years at Twitter. So it's pretty harsh, but it's also hard to defend the other direction, I would say.
Let's close off chapter one here. I think we'll come back in our chapter two to hear your final chapter of your book, which is, we open the curtains and welcome Elon onto the set. We'll be back in a moment.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like, what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like, what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Thank you.
We're back with part two of Bubble Trouble with Kurt Wagner and his book, Battle for the Bird. I don't want to talk about flipping the bird or any of those other sort of metaphors, but obviously Twitter. It's frequently a place where you see people flipping each other off. So, Kurt, let's go deep into the rabbit hole in the second half and the current state of the platform formerly known as Twitter, now known as X, where it's clear that its new owner, the savior you said they were seeking in the first half, has showed up, Elon Musk. And he clearly, you talk about this, he wants to turn it into a subscription platform, but that went badly wrong. They still have a lot of brand safety issues. And then, unfortunately, he tells all the paymasters, i.e. the advertisers, to F off. Not the most welcome sales strategy. I mean, tell us, what's the current state of X, the company that you've literally spent the last 5+ years, even longer as I've known you in your previous prior to Bloomberg, looking at? I mean, how do you feel about this business now under its new stewardship, if you can call it that?
Yeah, I'm pretty pessimistic, honestly, about where X is at. I mean, I think the issue is that their main revenue driver is still advertising. But Richard, as you point out, there are some brand safety concerns for sure, which when you are a brand advertising platform, which is what X still is, that's a huge problem. I think even bigger problem is Elon's own behavior, right? You mentioned that he stood on stage at Dealbook late last year and told advertisers to go F themselves. Well, guess what? A lot of their advertisers said, fine, we will leave. We will not spend money here anymore. And when that's the bulk of your revenue, that's a huge problem, right? He doesn't have the luxury of saying that because he has this huge other business that he can fall back on to sort of support the company. So I'm worried about X from a business standpoint because of that. I'm not sure that advertisers are going to come back to X as long as Elon is there. And as long as Elon is tweeting the things that he's tweeting every day, he got into a tiff, I believe it was a week ago, with a former Facebook founder, Dustin Moskovitz. And he called, like, I won't even say some of the words that he said, but he's like basically saying things that I'm uncomfortable saying on your podcast, but he's tweeting them publicly to 160 million people about a well-known tech executive, right? And it's just like the behavior to me is, it is just so problematic when you're running an advertising business. It's problematic no matter what, let's be frank, but it's definitely problematic when your revenue is dependent on it. And I think that's a problem.
If I can ask a dumb kid in the classroom question about ad revenue for a second, we talk about Twitter, small drop in the ocean relative to Facebook, to Google, and so on. Can you just help me and our audience understand the difference between found revenue and displaced revenue? Did Facebook eat Twitter's lunch and steal their ad revenue off them? Or did they just find revenue or find their own bigger lunch separate from what Twitter was doing? I'm interested to know, how does ad revenue grow? Do you find a new dollar or do you steal an old dollar?
That's a fair question. I would say budgets are just like with anything, like budgets increase pretty much year over year, like with inflation or growth. But if you are Twitter, you're probably looking to steal some ad budget from a Google or Facebook, which sounds like hard, but honestly, there are a lot of advertisers who are desperate looking to diversify their advertising budgets, right? It's one of the reasons Amazon has built a pretty sneaky big advertising business, is that a lot of marketers out there are going, we don't want to just be reliant on Google and Facebook. We want a third, fourth, fifth place so that it drives competition in the market. Richard's shaking his head. I don't know if you're agreeing.
I would say one of the key problems for Twitter is you never got a lot of time spent on the platform. Twitter was something that people would look at episodically and glance at. Whereas if you think about something like YouTube, it's easy to say, well, what just happened for those last 2 hours? I just kept looking at YouTube recommendation engine content or the endless scroll on your Facebook newsfeed. Oh my God, I haven't seen Marvin since high school. What is he? What is he doing? And these other platforms just did such a better job of capturing volumes of time spent. And where they all took it from, let's face it, is TV. So that new audience was all siphoned over from traditional TV. And Twitter just didn't have the products to get people to spend hours and hours on Twitter. It was something you glanced at and you engaged with periodically, not as a sort of hours and hours in your day.
And not just TV, right, Richard, but like traditional media too, right? Like print media, pretty much any other sort of like type of media buy that is, seems to be on the way out. But I would point out one thing that Elon seems to be doing. I'm not necessarily sure if he's doing it well, but he's certainly focused on it, is that time spent. He has talked about time spent as the owner of X a lot. And I get the sense that they've made some tweaks to the algorithm. I don't think they're prioritizing news anymore. And so when you open the algorithm, when you open the app, the algorithm is showing you stuff that, in my opinion, is meant to keep you on the platform, right? You are seeing more videos. You are seeing stuff that's not specific to news, but might be a little bit more inflammatory, gets you to click in and read the comments or whatever. So like, there are a lot of things that I think Elon is doing to try and increase the entertainment value of X in order to capture those ad dollars, as you mentioned. For me, though, the bummer is that I don't think that's what Twitter was good at. Like, Twitter was not the place that I went to be entertained. Twitter was the place I went to be informed. And they're getting away from that. And I'm worried that's like, that was their secret sauce, right? And I go, I can go be entertained on YouTube, on TikTok, on Instagram. I don't need a fourth place to just mindlessly scroll. I want some value from Twitter. And I'm not feeling like I'm getting that as much anymore.
Yeah. And equally, just one very simple use case, which the platform, I think, was really excelled at, is breaking news. But inserting, oh my God, forest fire rips through a small town, you kind of want to watch, but it's not a great place to insert advertising other than maybe for fire extinguishers.
It's brutal. I mean, I get like these, it'll be like, wow, can you believe like people didn't die in these car crashes videos, right? And it'll just be like the craziest like car crash. And it's truly, it's like you can't look away, but you're just like, what am I watching? Like, why is this showing up in my feed, right? But I feel like, to go back to your news, I agree 100%. Twitter was the place to figure out like what's going on right
breaking
now.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. If I'm trying to figure out what's happening with the Supreme Court, oh, I just saw a headline about a protest at Columbia University, whatever. I would open Twitter and expect to find, here's what's going on. And that's just not, that's unfortunately not happening anymore. And you could argue, hey, clearly that wasn't the best business in the world before, and that's totally fine, but at least it had value. I don't really feel like we're getting to the value part anymore.
So just thinking really quickly there about a trade-off between value and attention. And if I use the British sport of football, or soccer as you call it in the States, you could watch Match of the Day, which is asking for over an hour of your attention. You could watch the highlights on YouTube, which could be asking for 3 minutes of your attention. Or you could watch that fantastic goal on Twitter, which is asking for 40 seconds of your attention. I think people migrate towards that. Great, you've won attention, but you haven't got much attention from that high-value product. Push me onto a thread, which is 1 of 9, 2 of 9, 3 of 9 essay type stuff. That might not be as valuable, but it's clocking up more time. And I think that might encapsulate the economics of what you were saying earlier, Kurt.
I think so, but it's funny because the one example you used is maybe the worst example for what I'm arguing, because sports is the one thing that I think still kind of works on X, and sports highlights in particular are, like you just pointed out, that's the perfect use case for X is like, I don't have time to sit through 3 hours of a Major League Baseball game, but I can go on X and I can see a home run that changed the game in 20 seconds. And they've done historically a decent job of monetizing that because they come... They do partnerships with the NFL, with the NBA, with MLB, where they run pre-roll ads before that. So before I can watch that highlight, I usually have to sit through a 5-10 second ad. The problem is that's one industry. That's sports. Like, they don't necessarily have that same thing across the board.
Just to agree, but the current news, the current sports cycle is cramming a lot of value into a short space of time. It's good for me because I get what I want and I'm off within 60 seconds. It's bad for advertising sellers because there's not much dwell time on the platform.
Yeah, there's not as much inventory, right? Like, you only have that one 40-second clip versus a 3-hour-long television broadcast where you're going to be able to show 100 commercials, right?
So one of the things Elon said he was going to do, talks about it in your book, he's going to clean up the platform of all the bots. But in my experience looking at X, basically nothing's changed. And I'm not saying that all other social media platforms aren't ridden with fake user numbers and bad actors trying to siphon away attention and users and some version of surveillance capitalism. But do you think there has been a recognition and an effort to clean up all the automated traffic on Twitter? because one of the theses we always had is that it was a critical part of the volume of traffic, that it's easy for you to tweet once in a second, but a bot can tweet 10,000 times, and the retweets and all of that creates a volume of traffic. Do you think Elon has cleaned up all the bots on the platform, or is it just the same as always?
I think it shockingly might be worse, honestly, than it was when he took over. The problem is, I don't know.
He's just giving us a headline for the podcast.
I don't know if, like, this is just anecdotal, right? So I can't, because there's not data, or I wouldn't say there's reliable data around this, right? There's third parties.
He's cut off a lot of the researchers that were working on Twitter and showing bot storms and with data visualization, they would be able to show the way a Russian troll farm would retweet some complete invective up, guess what so-and-so did next kind of story. And now harder to see that.
So this is coming from I'll say my own personal perspective, and then maybe the perspective of colleagues that I talk to or close friends, whatever. But like, I've had to block more spam in my DMs than I ever had to pre-Elon. So for those who aren't aware, that's my DMs are my direct messages, like my private messages. I'll get hit up by clearly a bot, and I'll have to go in and delete them and block them and mute them. I'll post something and have crypto people, hey, buy Bitcoin here, blah, 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 reply to a tweet that has nothing to do with crypto. I never had that before Elon took over. Now, it's possible. I used to be a blue check on Twitter. I used to have like the verified account, and now I don't. So maybe I sort of lost some type of like
protection. Did you stop paying for it, or did he take it away from you?
I don't pay for it. Yeah. I mean, I never paid for it in old Twitter, and then I never started paying for it with X. But my point being is like,
you had it in old Twitter because you were recognized as a journalist. You had a voice.
Yeah. I was considered,
and you were valued as that. Yeah.
Prominent or whatever you want to say. So it's the reason I only bring that up because to say like, maybe they're under old Twitter as a verified account. Maybe I had like better spam filters or something than I do now as a non-verified user. I really don't know, but I'm certainly seeing more spam both in my DMs and in my replies. And I've heard from several colleagues and others sort of in the industry who are like, has the spam problem gotten worse? Like, what's going on? Which is just so ironic, of course, because that was sort of the whole crux of Elon wanting to buy Twitter outside of the free speech, was like, I'm going to clean up the bots. Right.
And you just mentioned the two words we've got to talk about, because there is no limit to hypocrisy, especially with Elon talking about free speech. But do you believe Twitter is now a freer speech platform than it was in the past? Or less free, certainly, if you're someone tweeting about the movements of Elon's private jet?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it gets really, the hypocrisy is quite stark. And I do get into this in the book, which is like, he wants people to be able to tweet anything they want so long as he is okay with it, right? And as you pointed out, like the location of his private jet, not okay. And so maybe on the net, like, is there more free speech, meaning are there more things you can say on Twitter without getting in trouble today than there were a couple years ago? I would say probably yes. But does it feel like more free speech? I'd say no, because you're still at the whim of this owner who can decide at any moment, well, I don't want people to say this, and therefore that's the new rule, right? And so it's not really as pure free speech as I think he wants you to believe, and certainly as some of his fans believe.
Kurt, this does remind me of a story we often tell on Bubble Trouble, which goes back to Facebook, Twitter's competitor, and an earnings call where Facebook announced, and this is in the early days of content moderation, Facebook were employing 10,000 full-time staff in content moderation to show they took this seriously. And Wall Street's reaction was for the stock price to fall. I don't know whether that says more about Wall Street ethics than it does about corporate performance.
Sure.
You take content moderation seriously? Dump the stock!
Right.
It's quite a depressing thing.
Look at that wasted investment, right? That's what
you could have been selling more banner ads.
Will, do you want to do smoke signals?
So we always bring the show to a close with our section called Smoke Signals. And I don't think we've ever had a more suitable guest for us to discuss this, which is Twitter grabs the headlines. There's no doubt about that. It might not grab Facebook's revenue, but it definitely grabs the headlines for good and bad reasons. And we're just asking you for a couple of smoke signals to help our audience understand those headlines. If somebody was to put on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Twitter's end is nigh, you might be thinking, not so fast. On the New York Times,
yeah.
Twitter's got a golden future ahead of us. Not so. What sort of warning signs can you give our audience about understanding the future of X, formerly known as Twitter? What? Give us the smoke signals that help us read between the lines.
Ooh. Well, there's a few. I'll tell you, there's a few things that immediately raise my, I guess, spidey senses, right? Which is maybe exactly what this is supposed to be. But like, the first is any graph or data around the company that Elon tweets out, right? So he's sort of does this.
That's
like
not a cumulative, Elon. That's not a cumulative.
Yeah, like he does this thing that where he'll be like, hey, here's time spent, and like it'll show a chart that's up and to the right, but it'll be missing like a y-axis, or it'll be missing an x-axis, or it'll be like my point is like
that y-axis didn't start at zero.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just with Twitter. Like, he kind of does this with Tesla. He does this with like some of his other companies too. But you just have to be really cautious about taking sort of the user success, the user growth stories that he shares at face value. And so that's one thing that sort of like I would just be cautious of if you're out there on X.
And certainly when he says, oh, we're almost free cash flow positive, that could mean we're still losing $1 billion. But, you know, we lost $1.1 billion a year ago, so we're moving towards free cash flow positive.
I mean, he's been saying, I haven't heard him say it in a while, but he was talking about getting to profitability at X for several quarters, right? And like, to your point, Richard, it was always like, we're almost there. Like, it's going to happen next quarter. Okay, well, now it's going to happen next quarter. And so he tends to overpromise, right? And so his promises, you got to take with a grain of salt. The other thing is like, and I'm reluctant to say that this should be dismissed because it's such a core part of what they claim they're trying to do. But I would just like the everything app idea, this term of everything app is a little bit exhausting to me because for me, what that means is like he sort of doesn't have a plan for X, in my opinion. He's trying a bunch of different stuff. He's just kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall. And in order to sort of cover for the fact that there's no clear plan, he just says, well, we're building an everything app. Like, we're literally going to have every product you could ever imagine. So that explains why I'm trying to do dating and video and banking and whatever.
I've seen this dance before, Kurt.
And so for me, I'm just sort of like, when I hear everything app, I'm reluctant to buy into that idea. And maybe he'll prove me wrong. And like 2 years from now, like we'll have a WeChat of the West and it'll be X, the thing that people have been hunting for the last decade. I'm just not convinced that's ultimately going to happen.
And indeed, you think about all of those other separate services. Someone is spending all of their time every day making it better and better for you. So to say, right, we're going to take over the language education market but isn't Duolingo doing a good job today? Or you can throw these things out there, but it is incredibly dismissive and quite blasé about the whatever thousands of people working in all those other apps, making them better totally. And having loyal users whose muscle memory, reflex, and brand loyalty is to those other apps for that function.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not getting rid of Chase Bank to leave my money at X so that I can both tweet and make a withdrawal within 30 seconds. Like, I'm very happy to open up another app to manage my money, right? And so, yeah, I'm a little put off by the everything app thing. But again, he talks about it a lot because that's supposedly the company's strategy. So I won't say dismiss it, but I would just say, with a grain of salt, take that with
you. And I guess it's going to be extra tough to do it once you fire 75 or 80% of the staff that works there. So you have fewer people to
it's
come
a little
up
tougher.
With everything apps.
Yeah.
A little tougher.
A little bit. Yeah.
Okay. Kurt Wagner, thank you very much for giving us your time. I really, truly enjoyed reading Battle for the Bird. Maybe only because I spent so much time watching this company from the outside and to see some more of the sort of inside baseball stories about how even more dysfunctional it was than I ever imagined. It's always heartening. Thank you for your time and joining us on Bubble Trouble.
Yeah. Thank you for reading. Thanks for the chance to talk about it. It was really good to talk to you guys. Appreciate it.
If you're new to Bubble Trouble, we hope you'll follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share it on your socials. Bubble Trouble is produced by Eric Newsom, Jesse Baker, and Julia Nett at Magnificent Noise. You can learn more at bubbletroublepodcast.com. Until next time, from my co-host Richard Kramer, I'm Will Page.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.